the dumbbell emanated, was a spot on the M20 highway just a mile or so east from the eastern edge of the city of Palmyra. Court had no idea what was at the center of the security cordon, but whatever it was, it involved two locations close to each other and a protected zone between them. Clearly the focus of the entire security operation lay both north and south of the highway to the east of Palmyra. This was key. He couldn't just call Voland and have him tell the FSA that Azam would be in Palmyra at a certain time. The FSA couldn't flatten the entire city. But if there was some sort of a Russian base a mile or so to the east of Palmyra, and Azam was planning on visiting it Tuesday, then that might represent actionable intelligence. The FSA might be able to send rocket crews close enough to attack the base, or set up shoulder-fired surface-to-air crews to target Azam's helicopter. Yes, Court now knew the where. As for the when, it was sometime between tomorrow, which was Monday and when the security cordon was supposed to be in effect, and Tuesday afternoon, which was when Azam had told both Bianca and Yasmin that he would return to Damascus. The what was not hardened intel. This was all still speculation that this security operation involved Ahmed Azam at all, but Court had executed many operations in his career on less solid intel than what he'd managed to acquire that corroborated his theory. So he was confident that the president would be coming to this area. Court stood back by the radios, behind Van Wyck, and concentrated on committing all the information he had just seen to memory. In the middle of thinking over what it all meant, he looked up and was surprised to see Van Wyck looking directly at him.
Kilo 9, pay attention!
Yeah, boss?
You're up!
What?
The Russian's Arabic sucks, apparently, so you're back on the mic.
Court took the radio and began speaking again with the Russians. He looked up to Van Wyck.
They say they can send a pair of Mi-24s for a couple of runs with rockets, but they are low on gas. After about two passes, they will have to leave to refuel, and it will take them an hour to return.
While Van Wyck discussed this with the Syrians, Court thought about this bit of information. Quickly, he realized this was the intel he needed. He figured the turnaround time to fuel an Mi-24 would be up to a half hour, and certainly not less than 15 minutes. If the Russian attack helicopters had to fly both ways from the hills north of the refinery to their refueling bladder, then they could make the entire trip, including refueling, in an hour. Court thought there was a significant chance this meant there was a Russian refueling operation set up around Palmyra, and possibly in the dumbbell on the map in the other room. There was nothing scientific about any of this, but all circumstantial evidence continued to point to a Russian base just off the highway east of Palmyra, and less than 25 kilometers from Court's present location. A Syrian major handed Court a sheet with the latest coordinates for the concentration of enemy forces trying to escape out of the hills. He wanted these exact coordinates relayed to the Russian helicopters. Court decided to slightly alter the coordinates when he read them out over the radio, with the effect being to send the Russians to a location about two clicks west of the actual position of the Free Syrian Army forces. He wasn't sure if it would save the guys on the ground or not, but he knew he couldn't send the helos too far, of course, or it would come back that they'd been fed completely incorrect coordinates. Minutes later, Court and Van Wyck left the command center, and minutes after that, the entire KWA strike force was outside the control building, hustling back to their BMPs to leave the relative safety of the refinery and head out with Ali Company towards the east. As Court surveyed the scene around him, he saw bodies in the distance, slumped forms near some storage tanks. He was too far away to know if the people killed had been combatants or not, but he was well aware of the Hawks' reputation for barbarism against civilians. He climbed into his infantry fighting vehicle with the others, then looked up to see that Braz was sitting right in front of him. The Croatian still stared Court down. Court said,
"Dude, anytime you want another shot."
Braz clearly did not want to start something, but Van Wyck sealed the hatch and looked in at the team. He saw the posturing between the two men.
"Braz, Wade, you start fighting in this tin can with me in here with you, and I swear to God I'm going to shoot you both."
Court and the Croatian both calmed down, but when the vehicle began bouncing on the road, it became obvious that any fight in these conditions would have likely resulted in more comedy than tragedy. Chapter 61.
In his office in central Paris, Vincent Voland hung up his phone and rubbed his tired eyes. While he had spent his morning coordinating with the Jordanians a means to rescue the baby and the nanny in Syria, and the noon hours spent pushing Drexler's photo out to all the airports and train stations in Europe, along with warnings that he was behind the attacks in France and might be trying to leave the continent, he spent the afternoon hours on deeper research into every shred of intelligence of known Syrian Mukhabarat activities in Europe. He focused on the physical logistics of the GIS, Syria's General Intelligence Service, because he assumed Drexler would use Syrian government resources to get back to Syria. He researched airports first, looking for any examples in the past 5 years of known Syrian intelligence forces using international airlines, charter outfits, or privately owned aircraft. He even examined examples of Syrians sending freight via air, thinking it possible they might simply use the same means to ship a Swiss spook working for the Azam regime as they would a shipment of jet avionics equipment or high-tech radar parts. When he knew everything there was to be known about how Syrian government spies had moved men and materiel via air, he targeted every company, route, and middleman, and he communicated with contacts he maintained in the intelligence agencies in the different locations involved. He sent the new high-quality photo of Sebastian Drexler and asked them to use their existing facial recognition assets to plug the image into the computers that analyzed security cameras around all the properties used by Syrian intel. When the air routes back to Syria were as well covered as he knew how to make them, he began looking into ship traffic, specifically any instances of the GIS in using ocean-going vessels to move themselves, other people, or items. A couple of private yachts in the Med had been flagged as belonging to shell companies owned by Syrian interests, and Voland had the yachts located and the facial recognition software scanning video in the areas around the marinas where the yachts were in port. Also through his work, he'd found out that in the past year, two cargo ships from Europe had been stopped in the Mediterranean and found with illegal goods bound for Syria. Voland had been in this game long enough to know that for every shipment stopped on the water, certainly a dozen, if not more, made it through. Reading over the maritime investigations done by the EU into those responsible for the shipments, he learned that one of the two confiscated cargoes had originated in Split, Croatia, and the other had departed from Athens, Greece. Digging into the cases deeper, he found the actual ports where both cargo ships took on their illicit cargo. Here, both trails went cold. In both Split and Athens, investigators had uncovered no paperwork showing a freight company, a trucking company, or any other details of where the goods came from or how they were loaded on board. Instead, in both cases, it had been random spot checks on the water that determined the ship had been carrying contraband, and the contraband had been sent using forged manifests that could not be traced back to a person or company. Still, Voland realized a ship from Europe to Syria would be a high-probability means of transportation for Drexler to return to Syria, especially since he must have known that by now he was being hunted at all the airports. The Frenchman sent Drexler's photo directly to the harbor masters of both ports where illegal Syrian cargo shipments had departed from the year before. Within an hour, he was told that facial recognition suites were up and running at every camera at both ports, including the marinas, the traffic cams, police cameras, even restaurant and retail stores in the two locations. Voland didn't celebrate this positive step in his hunt because he knew Drexler could be driving to Russia, or taking a ship to South America, or simply hiding out in Europe for a month before returning to his patron nation. These were just small steps, a few of many he would need to take today. Still, this was intelligence work. It required time, patience, and more than anything else, dogged determination. And in Voland's case, there was one more ingredient in the recipe. Voland was filled with and fueled by an intense passion to make Sebastian Drexler pay. Chapter 62. Court and his group of mercenaries spent the afternoon climbing into and out of their BMP-3 as the KWA team worked to clear buildings behind Desert Hawks Brigade Ali Company's spearhead to the east. None of the mercs had been read in on the entire operation, of course, But it was becoming clear to Court that the objective for this day was to simply move through some villages along the M20 highway for the purpose of looking for a fight. Recon by fire, it was called. The Hawks rolled down the road, shot off a few rockets and rounds, and looked to see if there was any sort of fighting force in the area interested in mixing it up. In the few cases during the afternoon where the militia did receive fire, Ali Company devastated the building or street where the gunfire came from, and then rolled on in their vehicles. If any structure in the target area was left standing, the KWA men were sent in for room clearing. Court hadn't fired his weapon in the past 3 hours of action simply because he'd seen no targets in the buildings he'd entered. He had seen dead and wounded. Some were fighting-aged males, and others were clearly civilians. They'd all been killed or maimed by Desert Hawk's weapons before KWA arrived. It was scene after scene of sickening atrocity, and all the while Court wondered how the hell he was going to get away from this so he could report what he'd learned earlier in the day in the oil refinery. About 5 PM, Court's BMP threw a tread, so he and the other 5 men from his team rode on the other KWA armored vehicle down a broken street, their weapons up in their arms. They'd been ordered to push on to the eastern edge of the little town and to find some hard cover high enough to get overwatch on the last village down the highway at the far edge of the security zone. The KWA men were alone in the village with their one vehicle. The main section of Ali Company had been called out of the town and sent up to the north. Court heard from Van Wyck that somehow the Russian helos that they'd requested to pulverize the retreating FSA force had not located them, so nearly the entire battalion had been ordered to go out into the desert east of the hills to make sure the FSA was out of the perimeter the Desert Hawks had been ordered to secure. The reason a dozen foreign mercs and a few vehicles had been the only ones left in the town had become clear to all minutes after arriving. There was nothing here left to kill. Court had seen the first decayed body the moment he climbed onto the other BMP and sat down next to the turret. Just off the broken road, inside a shelled storefront, a cadaver lay with most of its clothing still intact. He saw more bodies, some lying out in the open, over the next few minutes. He found himself confused by the placement and disposition of the corpses. They weren't blown to bits. They were just lying around, either in rubble or out on the sidewalks and streets. Saunders was seated at Court's shoulder and answered the question before Court posed it, by leaning into his ear to speak over the big engine and grinding tracks below them.
Chlorine.
What's that?
Gas attack. From the look of the bodies, it happened a couple of weeks ago. The Syrian Air Force dropped barrel bombs on the town. Looks like they used conventional bombs first, and a lot of them. And then just said stuff it and drop some chlorine. Killed everyone left who was out in the open. Bet it sank down into the bunkers and tore up some lungs and throats in there, too. Some of these poor buggers probably came running out of their holes to try to find air, but there was no air to be had.
Saunders sniffed.
Yeah, the gas is gone, but the stink of dead flesh is bloody obvious.
Right, Court said, and then... This doesn't bother you at all, does it?
Said the bloke who nicked somebody's baby.
Court turned away.
You guys are pure evil. You'll catch up, mate. The day isn't done yet, and tonight's gonna be a horror show.
2 hours before sunset, the unit had made it to the southeastern side of the village and found an overwatch on the top floor of a 5-story apartment complex. Court sat in a corner bedroom filled with trash strewn around amid the broken masonry. Through a window to the east, he could see the next town. And through a window to the south, he could see desert with low rolling hills. Anders sat nearby in the same room, and he scanned the south with his binos.
Wonder who's hiding up there?
Court had been thinking the exact same thing. While all day long he'd been hearing reports of fighting in the hills to the north, the hills to the south loomed much closer and more ominous to this little town. Van Wyck assembled the men in the living room of the apartment a few minutes later. He held his radio in his hand, and he was in comms with the Desert Hawks major back at the command post. The two men spoke in Arabic for a minute more before the team leader addressed the 11 men.
Right, here's the plan. The Hawks have finished their work in the northern hills, and they're on their way back here. Ali is linking with them 10 clicks out of town in the open desert, and at sunset, they're surrounding the next town on the highway. I am told they believe there might be some FSA elements in there from the force they encountered in the hills. They are going to start shelling after sunset, and you can expect the Hawks to pound that town with rockets, tanks, and mortars for a few hours. This is the outer edge of the security perimeter they've been asked to establish, and they don't want any enemy forces remaining.
What about us? Asked Anders. Van Wyck said, we'll go into the town behind the main element.
More room clearing? Braz asked,
a grumble in his voice telegraphing his feeling about it all. Van Wyck said,
there is a mosque in that town that has supported anti-regime forces in the past. The Desert Hawks don't feel great about flattening the mosque, so we're going in to clear it.
Saunders mumbled.
Pussies.
Court said, ROEs.
He was asking about the rules of engagement, and there was a snicker from one of the mercs in the back of the apartment's living room.
Van Wyck said, if they are in that mosque, they are considered hostile, no quarter given.
Court wanted to hear Van Wyck point blank say he was ordering his people to kill unarmed civilians, but he decided he wouldn't press it. The insinuation was clear, and anything else Court did to reveal that he was uneased by what was happening around him would just detract from his cover.
Anders said, boss, can you ask the TOC about those hills to the south? We're sitting ducks from any indirect fire positions up there.
Van Wyck looked out the window at the hills, and then he spoke into the radio. The major replied, and the South African translated.
He said those hills are outside the security perimeter, but SAA intelligence says it's a heavy opposition presence, so use caution. Still, he's not worried about an attack from the south.
Anders said,
of course he's not, because he's back at the fucking command post in the refinery.
Court asked, is it FSA or ISIS?
Van Wyck looked at Court.
The major said it was terrorists, which is the word they use for any opposition.
Saunders chimed in. Why? The only thing you need to know is that it's a bunch of hatey, beardy blokes who will pull the trigger as soon as they get your melon in their gun sights.
Court let it go. Anders pushed the issue of their isolation here.
There's a dozen of us total in this little town. If somebody attacks across that strip of desert from those hills, they could be on us in minutes.
Van Wyck said,
all right, Anders, I hear you. Just stay out of the windows on the south. Do not reveal your positions to anyone with long glass in that direction.
The meeting broke up, and a few minutes later, Court was back at his post by the windows to the east. He could still see out to the south as well, but he was staying far back in the room so he couldn't be sighted from that direction. He was frustrated about the intel he had about Azam and his inability to pass it on to those who could exploit it. He needed to get the hell out of here, and now. He'd done what he could to search the apartment for a cell phone while the team was settling into their defensive positions, but he'd not found anything other than a dead wall phone that had been ripped from the wall when bomb shrapnel had destroyed most of the unit. But even though this one apartment was a dry hole, he figured if he had enough time to search the ghost town around him, he would be able to find a phone, and with it he could contact Voland. But he wouldn't have the time, because he was going to be posted right here till it was time to climb back aboard the BMP and hit the next town. And getting back on mission wasn't the only reason he wanted to get the hell out of here. His stomach churned, thinking about the attack to come. The late afternoon sun was low now in the west. Looking to the east through binoculars, Court could see flickers of reflections from the few bits of glass still in the windows of buildings of the next town on the highway. He wondered if he'd find that this area had been hit with chlorine bombs like the one he was in now. And he also wondered if the Desert Hawks were going to utterly level it tonight when the sun went down. He was all but certain they would. And then he and his colleagues would go in and eradicate any survivors hiding in the rubble. With an entire battalion of militia raiding in the dead of night, along with a small team of shock troop mercenaries used to raid the mosque and kill anything that moved within, this was going to be a massacre. That much was clear. Court lowered his binos, then crawled back over to the window to the south. Anders was in the room with him, but the Dutchman ignored him as he dug into a bag of rice and ate it with his fingers. Court looked out to the southwest, into the low sun again, and then he looked out to the hills to the south. And he got an idea.
but it was not an idea that made him feel particularly buoyant. No. The sickening dread that he'd felt about taking part in this evening's slaughter was replaced by a sickening dread about what he'd just decided to do. Chapter 63. From his position on the floor in the corner of the apartment, Court looked around the bedroom a minute, searching for an item necessary to implement his plan. He couldn't find what he was looking for here, so he told Anders to cover his position for a moment, then went out into the living room. A few men sat around at the windows looking east, and none paid much attention to him. When he'd surreptitiously hunted for a phone earlier, he'd noticed a completely shattered boombox on the floor of the apartment, next to the overturned shelf where it had obviously stood. On the floor around the shelf were a dozen CDs, some in their cases, some lying loose. Court checked the men around him, and when no one was looking his way, he knelt and snatched up three of the CDs, then dropped them into a cargo pocket in his pants, and returned to the room in the southeast corner of the building. Anders finished his meal, then looked over at Court.
Hey, you got any wag bags?
Court knew what a wag bag was from his time in Ground Branch. Wag stood for waste alleviation and gelling, and it was effectively a toilet in a bag that an operator could use to dispose of his solid waste. It wasn't pretty. It didn't make the highlight reels of snipers or Navy SEALs in action, but soldiers, sailors, and operators in the field had been defecating into plastic bags for a long time. Court sighed a little to himself, because this meant his battle buddy was about to take a dump right next to him in this 4-meter-square room.
No, Anders, I don't. How about you try to hold it?
The Dutchman was already undoing his utility belt and heading to the corner.
Nope.
Court resigned himself to the fact that the next few minutes were about to get even more unpleasant than the last few. But then he turned to Anders as he realized this was the opportunity he needed.
Look, you Neanderthal, there is a shitter somewhere in this apartment. Why don't you go find it, and I'll do the same when my time comes. You think the plumbing works in this apartment's bathroom?
Of course not, but it's a little room with a porcelain bowl, and that's a lot better than you taking a big crap in the corner here. Have some respect for the homeowners, at least.
Why? They're dead.
He was probably right, Court realized, but he needed him out of the room. He said,
Dude, I'll watch your sector.
Anders refastened his belt with a shrug.
You're like a damn woman.
And with that, he left to go find the bathroom. As soon as he was gone, Court crawled across the floor over to the window that faced to the south. He sat with his back to the concrete eastern wall and looked back into the open room. He took one of the CDs from his pocket and held the shiny downside out the southern window, half pointing it towards the setting sun to the west. Turning around and looking through the hole in the middle as a sight now, he angled the disc towards the mountains to the south and moved it back and forth. He was careful to keep his head and body behind the wall next to the window, and also careful to keep his ears tuned to sounds around the apartment. If he was signaling the enemy with his head out in the open, a sniper hiding on the desert floor would have a prime shot at him, and if he was caught signaling the enemy by the KWA men, Van Wyck would shoot him dead right here, without question. For a full minute and a half, he flashed the hills, broadcasting his location to any possible enemy there, making it look like the lens of a pair of binoculars or a sniper scope had gotten caught in the setting sun. He heard footsteps right outside the room, so he dropped the CD and brought his hand back inside the window. The shiny disc fell to the street below. Court's elbow was still on the window ledge when Anders re-entered. He looked at Court there in the corner.
You moved.
I can see both sectors from here.
Yeah, well, you're going to get your arm shot off if you keep it there.
Court brought his arm in, then crawled back over to his side and began looking once again to the east. His idea had been for enemy fighters to begin harassing the building, with either snipers or mortars. Just enough for the decision to be made for the KWA men to withdraw from the area before dark. He didn't think his simple action was going to prevent the Desert Hawks Brigade attack of the town to the east outright, but he hoped it would at least get the Hawks to actually engage with soldiers on the other side of the fight, be they FSA or Daesh or Al-Jabhat or SDF, instead of simply eradicating civilians of the neighboring town. And he also hoped some sort of an attack might give him the opportunity to slip away, at least long enough to find a working cell phone. It occurred to him, this was like yesterday's bar fight, with stakes raised by a factor of 1,000. He felt like going AWOL would be the only way he could transmit his intel. He had 2 days' rations in his pack, and he could go to ground, make his way west back towards Palmyra, and provide even more intel if the FSA did try to engage Azam while he was at the Russian base. Just then, Fenwick leaned into the room.
Just got word from battalion. Shelling of the next town begins in 30 mics.
Roger that, Cort said, and Anders echoed this. Fenwick looked at his watch.
30 minutes after that, and we load up in the BMPs. Keep eyes on that village. Get me any intel you can.
Cort and Anders sat in silence for 20 minutes, and by now Cort had figured his plan to use the CD as a signal mirror to invite an attack had failed. He had a couple more CDs in a cargo pocket, but the sun was very low now, and he didn't see any way he could get another chance to... Saunders shouted from the living room.
Hey! I heard some pops! Keep eyes out for IDF!
IDF was indirect fire, and Cort realized his grand scheme to get himself shot at was going to work out after all. Seconds later, Fenwick started to call, incoming, but before the second syllable was out, 3 explosions ripped the desert floor in quick succession, just 80 yards south of the apartment building where Cort sat. A few tiny bits of debris pinged off the building, not far from where Cort sat near the southeastern corner. He knew these first shots would be ranging rounds. A spotter would determine how to adjust the mortars so that the next rounds would hit closer. Saunders stormed into the bedroom where Cort sat. The two men locked eyes, and Cort looked away.
What did you do?
What?
Did you signal somebody?
The fuck are you talking about?
There's no way we were seen from that distance. Impossible. You signaled them.
Anders looked at Saunders like he was crazy.
Why would he signal them? You weren't going into the next town. I saw it in your eyes when Boss gave the order. Figured you were gonna throw yourself down some stairs to get out of. Incoming!
Fenwick shouted now from the next room. 3 more rounds came in. This time they were much closer. The first 2 hit in the street just to the south of the apartment building, but the 3rd impacted against a lower floor. The resulting shaking knocked Saunders to the floor and sent loose debris and dust flying in all directions. Anders shouted now.
Why would he signal for an attack?
Saunders pointed at Cort, and he stood up in the cloud of dust, his face red with fury.
This fucker isn't here to work with us. He came here to...
Mortars!
Fenwick screamed.
And we've got multiple technicals inbound from the south. 1 click out. All call signs. Withdraw to the BMPs!
Cort hadn't expected them to attack that hard, and that accurately. The 3 men in the corner room ignored the order from the team leader. Saunders answered Anders's question.
Wei came here to Syria just to snatch that kid in Damascus, and he's using KWA for cover. He's stuck with us, but he's trying to find a way out of the country.
3 more mortar rounds slammed into and around the building, sending everyone flying and filling the apartment again with dust and smoke. Anders looked at Cort.
You kidnapped that baby they were talking about this morning?
Cort climbed to his feet.
Boss said exfil.
But Saunders blocked Cort's exit from the room. Cort said,
Not now, Saunders.
Anders climbed to his feet and made a run for the door. Saunders let him pass, but he pointed a finger at Cort.
You're fucking mad, calling in the enemy. You're gonna get us killed.
Not if we get out of here before we get... Cort stopped talking when he saw Saunders move his hand to the long knife he wore on his vest. A mortar shell crashed squarely on the roof, directly above the room. The ceiling collapsed in different portions of the apartment, and a dust cloud filled the room so thick that Cort could no longer see Saunders. He slung his rifle over his shoulder, threw his backpack on his back, and charged forward like a linebacker. Saunders had drawn the long knife from the chest of his load-bearing vest, but he hadn't expected the man hitting him so hard with his head low. Both men tumbled onto the ground in the debris, and Cort threw knees into Saunders's body and punches to his face. The knife came up in an arc that Cort couldn't see, but he felt the arm swinging freely, and he fell back and away quickly. The blade cut deeply into the magazine rack on Cort's vest. Realizing he was now in a life-and-death struggle with the British mercenary, Cort continued rolling backwards, kicking his feet over his head and flipping over onto his knees. He reached down to the SIG pistol in his dropped leg holster and pulled it free as heavy machine gun fire began raking the building. The entire scene was still clouded over with dust and building materials. Cort fell onto his back, worrying that the man with the knife could be inches away, and then he kicked himself backwards along the floor, gear and pack and all, until he hit the far wall. He couldn't see Saunders, but he knew where he'd been, and he aimed and fired 8 rounds as fast as he could press the trigger. His ears rang, and another mortar hit just outside the building, sending shrapnel into the room over Court's head. He stared forward in the thick dust and raised his weapon again to fire more rounds, but then Saunders appeared just 2 feet away, and coming fast. Court fired once into Saunders' chest plate before the British mercenary fell onto Court, knocking him onto his back. The man was already dead, a bullet wound in his left temple and another in his throat. Court pushed the gear-laden body off him, fought his way up to his feet, and ran out the door to the bedroom. 1 flight down the stairwell, he turned to go down to the first floor, and then he stopped abruptly. Anders lay face down on the landing, blood pooling under him. There was a ragged hole in the wall where a high-explosive mortar round had entered the stairwell, sending shrapnel out in all directions that eviscerated the Dutch KWA employee. Court continued his descent. He got to the front door of the building, and in the low light of dusk, he saw the 2 BMPs in the street, their engines running, their lights on. The rear hatches of both vehicles were closed, but a top hatch on the 2nd BMP was open, obviously waiting for the 3 contractors still in the building. Court considered making a run for the vehicle and climbing in, but he saw this as an opportunity. If he could lay low in the apartment building while the KWA men egressed, they would assume he'd been killed in the mortar attack. KWA wasn't a no-man-left-behind type of outfit. Of course, Court realized staying behind would still leave the non-significant issue of dealing with whoever was heading this way on the technicals Van Wyck had reported, but he figured he could try to find a basement and wait out the attack, then search for a phone to report his intel to Vincent Voland. It was a good plan, but the plan ended when Van Wyck rose up out of the hatch and saw Court standing there in the front door of the building.
"Move your ass!"
he shouted as he brought his Galil assault rifle up through the hatch and aimed it down the road, as if to cover Court. Court stood there, decided he would be better off exfilling with the contractors and then searching for another opportunity. And then he started running towards the armored vehicles. He made it fewer than 5 steps before he heard the unmistakable whiz of an incoming rocket-propelled grenade round. He ran on another 2 steps, and then his body was tossed into the air. The sound and fire came simultaneously, and after the incredible assault to his senses, he was blind and deaf. He did feel his body slam back into the street, pounding his right shoulder and right leg. He lifted his head and shook it a moment until he could just barely see a foggy, distorted image. It was the darkened road by the apartment building, and on it, the 2 infantry fighting vehicles raced off to the west. Court dropped his head back down into the street, and his helmet clanged. He felt a trickle of wet on his lips, and he licked it, tasted blood and concrete and dirt. He brought a hand to his face, rubbed his eyes a moment, and then focused more clearly. 3 pickup trucks raced past him in the street, coming from the southeast, and then they slammed on their brakes, skidding in the rubble all around. Armed men with beards and dark clothing leapt from the beds of the trucks, not 25 meters from where he lay. Court raised 1 hand to the men in surrender, but only for a moment, because his hand dropped back down as he lost consciousness. Court woke with a bag on his head and his hands tied behind his back. He was lying on his left side, bouncing up and down against the hard surface, and this told him he was likely in the bed of one of the technicals he saw just before passing out. He didn't know how long he'd been out, but he felt cool night air blowing on his arms that he'd not felt before, so he imagined some time had passed. His body armor had been removed, as had his boots, utility belt, and drop-leg holster. His watch was gone, as was his helmet. He realized he must have been stripped down to the dirty white t-shirt and the green, black, and brown camo battle dress uniform trousers he'd gotten from the KWA loadout room down in Babala, and the 2 pairs of boot socks he'd put on that morning. Men spoke Arabic above him. From the positioning of the voices, he suspected they sat on the sides of the bed and back at the tailgate, and he lay between them at their feet. But his ears rang still, and his head hurt too bad to even try to concentrate on what the men said. It didn't matter, really, he figured, because he knew all he needed to know about what was going on. He'd seen the dark clothing and the beards, both common with ISIS fighters, and he knew he was fucked. They'd only taken him alive so they could execute him more dramatically than a bullet to the head as he lay unconscious in the street. Whatever they did to him would be for show now, and he'd seen all the various manners by which they put someone to death on video. The beheadings, the burnings in cages, the drownings, tying men to landmines and IEDs. He'd seen children ordered to kill prisoners with guns and knives, and he'd seen mass executions where dozens of men would be taken one by one and put to death as a crowd looked on. The only thing ISIS had generated in its 5 years of existence, as far as court could tell, was a lot of inventive ways to instill terror via torture and death. And now he could do nothing but await his own miserable fate. The drive lasted a long time, but court had no ability to determine how long. He figured it must have been 8 or 9 p.m. when the vehicle began ascending into hills. And for another hour or more, it climbed and descended, turned on hairpin curves, and even stopped a couple of times. He nodded off, but came to when the tailgate slammed down behind him. Then hands grabbed his ankles and pulled him roughly out of the pickup. He braced as his torso was dragged on the tailgate, hoping whoever was pulling him had the decency to help him to the ground so he didn't fall 4 feet, although he knew there was no reason to expect such decency. As he feared, he fell straight down and crashed hard onto his back on dirt and rock. Multiple arms pulled him up to his feet now, then half walked, half dragged him down a gravel path and into an enclosed space, some sort of building. He was shoved against a wall and then pushed down on his butt. Even through the bag, he could tell it was pitch black in the room. And then, the hands guiding him let him go. The door slammed shut. He thought about his predicament, and he held out no hope. His bindings were well tied, and he'd heard the trucks of a dozen vehicles at one time or another during his ascent into the hills. So whoever owned this territory seemed to own it outright. The door to the room opened, and Court felt other men being shoved against him, pushed down onto the floor. These would be more prisoners, and this made him think that ISIS was storing prisoners so they could execute them en masse as soon as the sun came up tomorrow. Chapter 64. At some point, Court fell asleep, and he dreamed of his own death. He was with dozens of other men, all wearing the orange suits that ISIS loved to dress its prisoners up in as a way to dehumanize them. They were each taken one by one on a short walk, then pushed to their knees and shot in the back of the head. The dream was horrific, but more so as Court watched his fellow prisoners receive the shot that blew their brains out. When Court's time came, in contrast, he found himself oddly at peace. He thought about Jamal Medina and Yasmin Samara and Dr. Siddiqui, and he lamented that he could not fulfill his promises to help them. And he thought about Tariq and Rima Halabi and their 2 children, and about Bianca Medina, who, while certainly not innocent, was nonetheless still a mother who loved her child, and wholly undeserving of all that had happened to her. It was sad he wouldn't fulfill his mission here in Syria, but there was nothing he could do about it. So, as he walked to his death in the dream, he told himself it was finally time to let go, as if he knew a long-awaited and much-earned rest was coming for him. He welcomed the rest as he bowed his head and waited for the gunshot. Court woke suddenly to the sound of a man calling out in shock and fear next to him. He recognized the man's voice. It was Braz, the Croatian mercenary. He'd obviously kept his own mouth shut all night long to hide the fact that he was a European, a non-Muslim, and thereby would suffer more at the hands of these monsters. There was a small amount of light coming through his bag, and he thought it must be morning now. Court could hear Braz being dragged away out of the room, and as soon as he was pulled away, Court felt hands grabbing him. He was yanked roughly to his feet, frog-marched out of the room, and shuffled ahead. He heard a wooden door open, and he was turned, walked along a moment, then pushed down on a chair. Seconds later, the door he'd entered through slammed shut. His bag had been left on his head, but even through it, he felt the presence of someone standing in front of him. This would be an interrogation, of this, Court was sure. He wasn't going to reveal to anyone here that he was an American. If these assholes were going to execute him, They weren't going to do it with the special fanfare reserved for high-profile Islamic State prisoners. No, he'd rather get his head chopped off for a small crowd and his body dumped in a sandy ditch and be forgotten than show up on YouTube in some insane music video-style execution. A man spoke to him now. It was in Arabic, of course, but Court understood the words.
"What is your unit?"
Court did not reply. If he said anything in Arabic, that would be just the same as indicating he was a foreigner, because he couldn't fake the accent, dialect, or language skills of a native Arabic speaker. He felt a blow on the side of his head.
"Hey, what is your unit?"
Still, Court didn't reply. The man stepped away, then muttered something to someone in the room, but this Court couldn't make out. Again, the interrogator tried.
"You were with the Desert Hawks, but you don't wear their uniform. Where do you come from? Are you Syrian?"
It occurred to Court that if this asshole just pulled the bag off Court's head, he'd probably be able to figure out for himself that he wasn't a local. He received another smack to the side of his head, and although he had fantasies about launching himself up and headbutting his interrogator into a coma, he did not react to the hit. From the far corner of the room, Court heard the sound of a wooden chair being pulled across the concrete floor, slowly. He tracked the sound all the way up to him. Whoever was dragging it along was making a dramatic show of coming closer, slowly and ominously. The chair stopped just a couple of feet in front of where Court sat, and then it was swung around. Again, Court could hear its placement by the scraping sound. The wood creaked as an obviously large man sat down on it. It was already dark inside the bag, but it suddenly got even darker as the man seated in the chair in front of him leaned right into his face. Nothing was said for several seconds. Whoever this guy was, he was patient, intense, and he knew how to intimidate a prisoner. Finally, he spoke.
"English?"
Court did not reply. A few seconds later, the man repeated himself.
"English."
Despite his decision to show no reaction to his interrogator, Court cocked his head a little. Something was off about this guy's accent. The man spoke a third time, and this time, as soon as the words left his mouth, Court felt the hair stand up on the back of his neck, because the accent was unmistakable now.
"Hey, dickhead, I asked if you spoke English."
This asshole was from the United States. Court hesitated just a moment, and then he replied,
"Dude, you take this bag off my head, I'll quote Shakespeare."
The bag came off slowly. Court blinked away the brightness of the room, even though the only light came from a large opening in the plywood ceiling of the stone block room that looked like it had been created by a direct hit from a mortar round. He then focused his eyes on the man sitting 3 feet in front of him. He was American, clearly, in his late 20s or early 30s. He wore a gray t-shirt under tan body armor. There were tats on both forearms, and he had sandy brown hair and a thick beard that looked like it had been growing for months. His green eyes looked at Court with absolute suspicion, but Court was almost overcome with relief. The man wore no insignia on his gear or clothes, but he was clearly a member of the U.S. military. The man said,
"Well, well, aren't you an interesting son of a bitch? What's your name, Slick?"
"Why don't you just call me Slick?" Court found he could barely talk, his throat was so dry.
"All right then, Slick, what's your story?"
He swallowed roughly, then said,
"No story, just passing through."
"Sweet. Thanks for dropping in our little corner of paradise."
"Pleasure's mine. Got any water?"
"Yeah, loads. But we don't hand it out to terrorists."
"I'm not a terrorist."
"Oh, cool. Then I guess you can go." Court looked past the American and saw a half dozen smaller Arab men back by the door of the dim room, looking on. Some had AKs and some were unarmed. But to a man, they all wore black tracksuits with no uniformity, and some wore headbands. They looked like a sloppy soccer team. A couple had short beards or mustaches, but most were clean-shaven. Court could tell in an instant this wasn't a jihadi group, like he'd first thought when he saw them from a distance in the low light the evening before. No, these guys were likely FSA, the Free Syrian Army, and this was the best news he'd had in a very long time. Court tried to determine exactly who the American was now. Most likely he was U.S. Army Special Forces, a Green Beret, though he could have been from one of the Whiteside SEAL units,
or possibly even the Army's Special Mission Unit, commonly referred to as Delta Force. The bearded man just looked Cort over, saying nothing, so Cort added, "Let me help you out. This is the part where you ask me who I'm working for." The man smiled.
"Is it? Okie dokie, thanks for the tip. Who are you working for?"
"I can't tell you."
"Is that because you're working for ISIS, working for Jabhat al-Nusra, or working for the SAA?"
"None of the above." The big American stood up fully, reached into his belt, and pulled out a pair of thick contractor gloves. As he began putting them on, he said,
"Let me tell you about a little unwritten rule we have around here when it comes to prisoners.
Can't wait.
Talk shit, get hit.
I wonder why you haven't written that one down." The soldier laughed, genuinely enjoying the repartee.
"Bunch of tight asses at the State Department and Pentagon send us memos telling us we can get in trouble for cold-cocking a prisoner without cause. But something tells me I can get away with it as long as the prisoner is another gringo. I think I might have to bust your smart-ass mouth just to find out."
Cort smiled. He liked this guy.
"You're SF. Fifth group, third? No. You're 10th group."
The American blinked when Cort said the third number, so faintly the man didn't realize it himself. Cort said,
"Yeah, Fort Carson. But doubt you're seeing much of Colorado these days."
"Who the hell are you?" the man asked. He sat back down on the chair, forgetting about his gloves and his plan to punch his prisoner in the face.
"Can't tell you that. But I bet you $20 I can guess your name."
Cort squinted in the sunlight beaming through the hole in the ceiling, looking over the man's face.
"Bobby, Billy, Randy, Ronnie. You look like a Ronnie."
The bearded man now made a slight but obvious reaction. Cort took this to mean he'd nailed it.
"Okay, Ronnie. How about you have one of your little guys back there bring me some water? It will help me talk."
The American in the body armor called out to the men behind him without taking his wide eyes off his prisoner.
"Me'al au sirab."
"Water."
A young man with a wispy beard and a shiny black Adidas jacket with white stripes pulled a bottle of water out of a pack on the floor and brought it over. He spoke English to the soldier as he handed it to him.
"Who is this guy?"
"Don't know yet."
Cort was not untied, but the American soldier squirted several ounces of water into his mouth. Cort drank it down, closing his eyes a moment as he let the water bring him back to life. Then he said,
"Ronnie, you've got a tough job, but I'm going to make it a little bit easier today."
"Are you?"
"I'm going to give you a phone number that will connect you to an office building in McLean, Virginia. Call it yourself, or kick it up to your command and have them call it. This will get straightened out, and I'll get out of your hair."
"McLean, huh?"
"That's right." "You're saying your CI..."
Cort shushed him before he could finish it. The SF man scratched his beard. It was clear to Cort that the man wasn't sure what to do. Another bearded American with body armor and forearm tats entered the room and spoke before he looked up and saw his colleague in the middle of an interrogation.
"Hey, Robbie, second platoon snipers spotted SAA helos about 10 clicks north of..."
He stopped dead in his tracks. Cort nodded to him.
"Hey, man. Any chance you can run and grab the sat phone for Robbie? He's got a really important call to make."
The new Green Beret stared at the prisoner for several seconds before turning to the big man sitting with Cort.
"What the fuck?"
"He says he's an American."
Cort chuckled.
"Either that, or I'm a Bedouin camel herder who just watched a shit ton of Sesame Street growing up."
Robbie said,
"And he's telling me he's OGA.
OGA meant Other Governmental Agency, and it was the down-low way of saying CIA when out in the field.
Cort shook his head. "Didn't say that, Rob. Said they'd vouch for me. Look, you're obviously in charge here, so that makes you, what, a captain? None of your business, slick."
Cort said, "Lieutenant then, got it."
The other man in the room laughed, despite himself. Cort was clearly the last thing they'd expected to run into in the hills of the Syrian desert. He said,
"You want me to get the phone?"
Robbie said,
"Negative. Take the FSA guys and give me a few minutes alone with my new friend here."
When the room was empty, other than Robbie and Cort, the American Green Beret said,
"You gotta help me out, man. You're saying you are or are not CIA.
Cort shrugged. "I'm something, Robbie. That's really all I can tell you. Just put me on the phone with them. That's not me playing tricks, that's me doing you a favor. The person on the other end of the line is going to be really pissed off that I'm right here, right now, in your custody, and there is no sense in them taking out their anger on you. Robbie just stared at Court another minute, still in silence. Court said,
All right. I'll cut you in just a little, but I'm code word, so your TSSCI clearance doesn't get you into the party. You can't even know I exist, understood?
Robbie nodded, a dazed look on his face now.
I'm on the job. I was in cover as a contractor for a regime-backed militia, but one of your little buddies RPG'd me, and I ended up right here. Now I've got to get back on my time-critical mission, and the only way I can see to do that is to have you talk to Langley so they can tell you to let me go.
Robbie said, The other guy the FSA picked up?
He goes by Braz. He's a Croatian mercenary working for KWA.
Those bastards.
Yep.
They shot civilians yesterday at the refinery along the M20 highway. Don't know what you can do about it.
Robbie shrugged.
Me either, in the grand scheme of things. But I sure as hell can make him miserable while I've got him,
Court said.
Talk shit, get hit.
The man smiled.
I bet a merc who just committed war crimes is gonna talk some serious shit.
Before you tune him up, you mind making that call?
Robbie nodded slowly.
Okay, Slick. I'm curious enough to play along.
He was on board now, at least partially. He squirted some more water in Court's mouth, radioed for the sat phone to be brought to him, and then went out into the hall, leaving Court tied up alone in the room.
Robbie was curious. He wasn't stupid.
A half hour later, Robbie and three other Americans walked purposefully back into the room. Robbie pulled a knife off his chest rig and cut Court free. As Court stood, the soldier extended a hand.
Captain Robert Anderson, 10th SF. Pleasure to meet you, sir.
Court shook his hand.
I was pretty happy to run into you myself. I apologize about the treatment. We hear some tall tales in this job, and I've run into a couple of Brits running with ISIS and Al-Nusra. So even your American accent didn't prove you were on the level.
You'd have been a fool if you acted any other way.
I checked with my command, and they okayed me calling the number you gave me after they checked it out to make sure it went to Langley. I spoke with a woman there, she wouldn't give her name, but she confirmed you were one of hers. She didn't seem too happy to hear from me.
Her name is Suzanne, and I'm only telling you that because it would piss her off if she knew that I did.
Yeah, well, she wants you to call her ASAP. Here's the phone.
Court took the phone. I'll call her boss. He'll be just as pissed about this. But it'll also be a little more helpful.
I don't really have much of an office, but you can use my hooch for some privacy.
Captain Anderson led Court out of the little mud, stone, and plywood building and through a warren of similar structures, all built deep in the hills. This Special Forces forward operating base was well hidden here, protecting it from possible Russian or Syrian aircraft above, and the FSA unit they were embedded with held a solid-looking defensive perimeter. Robbie told Court there was one ODA here, or Operational Detachment Alpha, meaning a dozen Green Berets working with some 75 FSA fighters. The Americans were here fighting against ISIS, not the Syrian regime, but the FSA fought against both groups. Anderson led Court into a small room on the ground floor of a bombed-out building and told him no one would disturb him during his call. Court sat on the cot, looked at the phone in his hand, then took a deep breath. He dialed a number from memory, but he wasn't really sure what he would say when the call went through.
Chapter 65.
As the director of the National Clandestine Service of the CIA, Matthew Hanley often worked late into the evening. Today had been no different. He arrived at his office in McLean, Virginia, just before 8 a.m., and it was just after 9 p.m. when he crossed the Potomac River on his way home to D.C. His driver got him back to his Woodley Park neighborhood by 9:15, but just a few blocks from home, Hanley changed his mind and decided to go out to dinner instead. Hanley was a bachelor in his mid-50s, a former Green Beret, and he didn't splurge on much in life apart from good food and wine. Tonight, he made the last-minute decision to indulge at the Bourbon Steak restaurant in the Four Seasons Hotel, not because he had anything special to celebrate, but rather because the pressures of his job had him certain it would kill him one of these days, so why shouldn't he enjoy a good meal while his heart was still beating? He and his four-man security detail entered without a reservation, but a table for one was found in the center of the room, and Hanley ate while his detail maintained a discreet 360-degree watch over the dining room and the street out front. Apart from an urgent call from the office, he enjoyed the first half of his meal in silence at his table, while he listened to the soft murmur of conversation from others seated around him. Well-heeled couples talked about their kids and marriages, business people discussed their work, and foreign travelers to D.C. spoke in foreign languages, most of which Hanley understood, and the big man in the middle listened in on it all while he dined alone. At 10:30, he poured the last of his first full bottle of Cabernet into his glass and was just about to cut off another slice of his 22-ounce bone-in ribeye when his cell phone rang. The sound of the ring told him it was on his encrypted app, so he decided he should answer it. This was his second encrypted call of the past 45 minutes, and he was certain it would have some relation to the first.
Hanley.
Hey, Matt, it's me. It was Violator, Cortland Gentry, Hanley's wayward lone wolf asset. Hanley put his fork on his plate and leaned back from the table.
Yeah, I know. Brewer called. She's about to have an aneurysm.
Fingers crossed. Matt smiled but didn't let Court hear him chuckle. He took a sip of his Cabernet with his free hand.
So, last I heard you were in Frankfurt, about to go on vacation. Did you get off at the wrong bus stop on the way to the beach?
Yeah. The one in the Syrian desert.
Right. Some indigenous forces working with an A-team captured you in the middle of a firefight. Thought you were ISIS or Al-Nus. I trust you've charmed the hell out of them and smoothed things over.
Yes, sir. We're all gonna get matching tats when this is over.
And you want my help in getting the hell out of there.
There was a pause on the line.
Court. I don't want to leave, but I do need some help. You're on the job,
Hanley said it as a question.
Aren't you getting support from your employer?
Negative. The guy running me is untrustworthy. I might just go it alone from here on out. Now Hanley put his glass down.
If you were going it alone, we wouldn't be talking. What do you need?
Not sure how much I should tell you, actually.
The line is clean, but you know that. You don't know how much you should tell me so that I maintain plausible deniability over what you are about to do. Is that it?
In a nutshell.
Well, maybe keep it vague. Theoretical. Hypothetical.
Court breathed into the phone a moment. Then, let's say an opportunity arose where someone could eliminate a very bad actor at the center of a very bad situation. Hanley looked around for the waiter. And when the two men met eyes, the big man lifted his empty wine bottle. He had a feeling he was going to need some more alcohol in the next few minutes. Court was talking about assassinating Ahmed Azam. There was no question in Hanley's mind. He controlled his own breathing and said,
"Go on."
The elimination of this bad actor might well help things, but it might not have any real effect. Who knows? Things could conceivably get worse.
The future's hard to predict.
That's right. I guess I'm trying to decide, should this person in a position to do this thing to this bad actor act, or should he wait for someone with more knowledge of the situation to decide if the elimination of the bad actor is the right thing to do? Hanley said,
"You want a vague answer?"
I want an ironclad thumbs up or thumbs down, but I'll take what I can get.
You are after my blessing, then?
Something like that, I guess.
Well, kid, I can't just give you carte blanche to delete anyone in the world you want to delete, officially or unofficially.
I understand.
Having said that, Hanley continued, I've learned over the years that you have pretty fair judgment.
Court did not reply to this.
And if the question is, do we take a bad actor off the game table, even if we don't know what will come next? I kind of have a philosophy about that.
I'd be very interested in your philosophy, Matt. Hanley kept his voice low as his eyes flitted about the room.
If a bad guy gets dead, well, it might make the next bad guy think a little bit. It might not. There's no silver bullet to fix every problem. But at the end of the day, a little street justice, an eye for an eye, well,
That might be the most sure thing there is out there to hold back the monsters.
There was a long pause.
I have been thinking pretty much the same thing.